Good morning. It is 10:31 a.m. We are here today, June 28, 2023, the Zoom meeting for the motion hearing continuation of OPAPA 23-002, John Dell International Inc., DBA JMI Edison versus the Guam International Airport Authority. Presiding over the hearing today is Hearing Officer Joseph B. McDonald. For the record, also present from the Office of Public Accountability are Jared Hernandez and Tirza Bagana. Will appellant JMI please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Hearing Officer. This is Joshua Walsh here for the appellant JMI Edison.
Thank you. Will purchasing agency GIA please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning. William Brennan from the Ariola Law Firm for the Guam International Airport Authority, and we will not have a management representative present for the motion hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Will interested party Aircraft Services International Inc., DBA Menzies Aviation, please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
This is Mars Johnson from Blair Sterling Johnson and Martinez for interested party Aircraft Service International Inc., DBA Menzies Aviation. We will not have an institutional representative with us.
Thank you. May proceed.
Thank you and good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So today we're going to hear the objection to my appointment as hearing officer. I will note that it appears that the only party to file an objection is the purchasing agency. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Mr. Walsh, Mr. Johnson.
That's correct. We didn't, to be clear on the record, we didn't object and we did not oppose file an opposition on Monday either.
Okay. I want to confirm with the airport that all that was filed was the objection consisting of 5 pages. Is that correct?
5 pages, yes.
Okay, so I did take a look at it. I just have a few questions, if that's okay, Mr. Brennan.
Sure.
Regarding your objection. Okay. You note that none of Mr. Rosano, Mr. Walsh, nor myself provided any other information regarding the disclosure. Are you stating that one of us may have an obligation in this regard to provide any information relayed by Mr. Charles McDonald to Mr. Rosano regarding his representation?
To be clear, I mean, Mr. McDonald is not, as I understand it, you know, within the jurisdiction of the OPA related to this case. So I wouldn't suggest that he has to disclose anything. I think our position would be that because the appellant's counsel felt that a disclosure was necessary, that under the statute, under 12116, the hearing officer, or excuse me, the public auditor would normally have to make a disclosure of facts necessary to address a DQ question. And we believe that since a hearing officer has been appointed, that obligation would extend to the hearing officer. And thus, there should be some disclosure of facts which informs the parties about the disclosure itself. So yes, our position would be the hearing officer has that obligation based on 12116. And, you know, to the extent your appointment, I believe to the extent your appointment gives you the powers of the OPA, I would suggest that implicitly that comes with the duties and obligations of the OPA in presiding over these hearings. And when I say OPA, I mean the public auditor and your, I guess, appointment and sitting in his place.
Okay, then. So for the record, I have no relevant facts to provide because this is not a matter that touches the firm. And so I have nothing to provide in the way of any relevant disclosures other than, of course, that Charles McDonald is my partner in the firm.
Could I just be heard on that? Unless you want to do your questions first, I think that does highlight a point I'm trying to raise in our papers.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think that is the issue we're having is that if as the appointment order and as I'm just going to call you Your Honor, but as you know, Your Honor,
you call me Mr. McDonald
or Mr. McDonald, as you suggested last week, if the actual bias standard is going to be the standard that governs your competency in this proceeding, it's difficult for the airport, and it really puts us in a circular position where we have to establish an actual bias, but in doing so, we don't have an accurate picture before us. And while I appreciate both yours and JMI's counsel's statement that this is a personal matter unrelated to your firm, we are left with only the ability, and I'm going to say speculate lightly, because I recognize the case law says it shouldn't be speculative, that shouldn't be enough, but it's circular really, because if there is no further disclosure to be made, we're forced to speculate on what this could be. And so, given that this individual is the partner at the firm you're employed with, even personal matters could impinge on the professional association you have with this individual. And I don't want to get into, you know, what this could be, what, you know, Mr. Rizzano's areas of practice that are relevant here might possibly suggest to me. But there could, in our view, be situations where sensitive information in the hands of appellant's counsel could give rise potentially definitely to an appearance of impropriety in our view, but maybe to actual bias. And we just, without knowing what that could be, we're forced to speculate. And because we speculate, it's impossible for us to establish actual bias, but we can't establish actual bias because of the lack of a complete disclosure. So that's the procedural piece we're trying to raise here, that if the OPA, the public auditor, is required to disclose all relevant facts, and you have determined you don't have any relevant facts, part two of our objection is then there should be an objective third party weighing whether that's correct and whether you are required to provide more if you're going to sit on this case, or whether your disclosure has been sufficient and the airport is just speculating. So that's kind of what we're trying to register here.
So I guess to make it clear on this point, you can't even begin to speculate.
Correct. Yeah, that would be our position, that while speculation is not enough, we're forced to, you know, speculate as to what we would speculate is how I put it.
So just to make sure, you can't even begin to speculate that I would in some way, shape, or form be imputed with a matter that Mr. McDonald discussed in confidence with his attorney that actually creates an actual bias against the airport. Correct?
I wouldn't go that far, because I don't think the standard is bias against the airport. It's bias in favor or against any party, and we just wouldn't know. And so I wouldn't go as far to say that we would have to speculate as to a basis of actual bias. I would say that we are being forced to do so by the lack of complete disclosure. And I don't want to belabor it. We filed what we filed for the record. It's, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. But okay. That's, yeah.
So I'll just say again, for the record, a complete disclosure has been made to the extent that the parties have the relevant information and are allowed under the rules to share the information. Okay. My next question is, you seem to take issue with the application of Sule, which, of course, Menzies believes that's the proper standard. And I guess my question is, how would we get there if this is binding precedent?
I'm afraid I don't understand the premise.
Well, when I read Sule, it definitely talks about administrative adjudication, right? And then it says, and it actually cites, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, it cites to another provision for disqualification of hearing officers. And then it says that it suggests that the standard is actual bias. And that's, I think, from the text of Sule. So how would we not apply, why and how would we not apply Sule and take a jurisdiction, take a jurisdiction's authority instead of the Supreme Court of Guam's authority? How and why would we do that?
Yeah, so I think what we're trying to point out is in the Sule case, the Supreme Court was very clear that the reasoning it adopted from federal circuits had to do with small communities disciplining. Sorry, we lost somebody on my screen. Are we all still here?
We're all still here.
Okay. And so, you know, I think there was some express reasoning adopted from the Seventh Circuit that said that, you know, in a small community where there's professional discipline and members of that profession who are essentially in competition with, in that case, a dentist, then you'd have to use actual bias because there would always be this appearance of impropriety since your competition sitting on a board in front of you. It also cites to the administrative adjudication law, that's correct, in Guam, related to hearing officers. I think a distinction needs to be made, and our position would be there is a distinction between a hearing officer and a disciplinary proceeding, such as, you know, as we're all familiar with regulation counsel and, you know, the several boards that follow that process. And in this case, the OPA's specific rules for procurement appeals and hearing officers. I've not seen... as far as I know, anything to say that, you know, we just wholesale adopt the AAL and apply it to these proceedings. I think these rules are separate. And, you know, that's just our position. If the Supreme Court had said specifically all hearing officers, even in adjudicatory capacities, are subject to disqualification only on showing an actual bias, I'd have a little bit more comfort. I just don't know that that case stands for that proposition completely yet. It may, but. We looked at Seventh Circuit reasoning that we cited in our brief.
Fair enough. So you would have then that the appearance of impropriety, right? Although no hearing officers have taken oaths or done any of those things, they're not in a separate branch, they're not one of the checks. You would have that the hearing officer also be judged by that standard.
Yeah, and consistent with those persuasive ethical rules governing ALJs, which is what I think the hearing officer in this type of proceeding is acting as more than in a disciplinary case. And that's why we cited to the persuasive authority, just to demonstrate that this question has been answered differently.
So you would agree, though, that what we are dealing with, after all, is administrative adjudication, whether it's in the form of a disciplinary hearing or in the form of an OPA appeal.
Yeah, absolutely. You are adjudicating a dispute, but it's not, I wouldn't go as far as to say this is the AAL. I think the OPA has specific rules as it's been authorized by statute to adopt.
Okay. And those statutes work together, or they work, do they work together or not in your view?
I don't think they do. I mean, in the AAL, the attorney general would be the one appointing the hearing officer. We'd be entitled to depositions under that process. There'd be a complaint and adversarial process. I think this is coming on review of a procurement protest and decision of an agency, which is different.
Yeah. Okay. And you so the difference is really just in sort of the additional rights regarded in due process hearings, like for instance licensing, to conduct discovery, that kind of thing.
I don't know that I would say that's the only, I mean, that's the procedural difference. There's some substantive difference between the protections afforded in the AAA versus the procurement code. I mean, it's a bit, you know, they're two different statutory schemes, I guess. It's substantively and procedurally, there are differences, would be our position.
Okay. Is there anything that you read in the administrative adjudication law that restricts application only to certain instances? And within the ambit of administrative adjudication?
If I understand your question correctly, I mean...
Is there something specific in the administrative adjudication law that makes you believe that where, you know, there is authority there to interpret what's going on in a proceeding, that it says wholesale it doesn't apply to this or wholesale it doesn't apply to that? Is there anything in the administrative adjudication law that circumscribes its application to only specific instances? And does that also include the OPA especially?
I think that the difficulty I'm having with the question is the opposite conclusion, right? Because it's either it all applies, in which case it should supersede the OPA rules, or the provisions you need to apply are going to apply, which I can't see working.
I guess that's
how I'd answer that question is, it's either we take everything and get rid of the OPA rules in our view, because the piecemealing, I don't think it would be fair to litigants in the procurement appeal process.
Okay. I mean, I don't want to belabor this point, but it seems to me that the Sule case was about disciplinary proceedings where they had specific rules, but the Supreme Court still cited, or at least, entertained that portions of the Administrative Adjudication Act would apply. So I'm not sure I read it the same way.
Fair enough.
Okay. So, I mean, I just need to put this on the record. I'm sorry if I sound a little forceful with this point, but is there any lawful basis by which GIAA would compel Charles McDonald to make a disclosure?
No, right? Not in our view. It's
okay.
Yeah. I don't think not in our view at this time.
Okay. In your review of the relevant authorities, have you found a statute that says a hearing officer is out without jurisdiction to hear a matter of his own disqualification?
We cited to, 12109, which is the powers of the hearing officer. It doesn't explicitly grant the hearing officer that power. And I think the way I'd highlight this point is, in our view, if you're saying that if, as I understand the position, there's some implied power just because you get what the OPA gets, how I answered that earlier question, I think would also apply. You also get those responsibilities. So that would be the authority we're relying on, is 12109. And then we cited, generally to procedure used by, for example, the courts, that it's not appropriate for a judge to hear the question of their own disqualification. But no other statute that we cite, or we did not cite another statute.
Okay. I'm looking at 12109. And you're right, it doesn't expressly state it. But it does state that the hearing officer has the power to hold informal conferences, et cetera, require parties to state their positions with respect to the various issues in the proceeding, require parties to produce for examination those relevant witnesses and documents under the control, rule on motions, and I'm not sure I see a limitation that's even expressly, so I think we come to the same position on that. And then I'll just cut to AAL 9222. Have you had the opportunity to review that section?
I did.
Okay. And it states disqualification of hearing officer. A hearing officer or other agency member shall voluntarily disqualify himself and withdraw from any case in which he cannot afford a fair and impartial hearing or consideration. So I think at least the administrative adjudication law allows the hearing officer to decide on his matter of disqualification. Says there shall voluntarily disqualify himself and withdraw from any case in which he cannot accord a fair and impartial hearing or consideration, which of course is the language that was cited to in Sule, where the Supreme Court stated that this suggests actual bias. Then it goes on to state Any party may request the disqualification of any hearing officer or agency member by filing an affidavit prior to the taking of evidence at a hearing stating with particularity the grounds upon which it is claimed that a fair and impartial hearing cannot be accorded. And of course, your position on the record seems to be you can't even begin to speculate, correct?
Correct. And also that 9222 would not necessarily apply in this case. And it's why we didn't follow that procedure filing an affidavit.
Okay. And, you know, in preparing, of course, I've reviewed 1909, Duties of the Public Auditor, 9220, the Hearing Officer, as it's described in the AAL, 9221, the Hearing Officer's Powers and Duties, and also GAR 12109. Apart from those statutes, are there any other statutes or regulations that you would point me to support your position on disqualification for the standard that's articulated in your motion within statutory or regulatory authority?
Just 12116. It speaks about the public auditor's duty to disqualify.
And let me just pull up 12116, that was right?
Yes.
So even in that, this kind of loops back into the earlier point. If you look at the last sentence of 12116, if no member of the public auditor's staff or the appointed hearing officer is able to preside over the matter due to disqualification, then such matter may be taken to the Superior Court of Law. So the only basis for which I can see the disqualification comes about in 9222, unless I'm going to adopt the other jurisdiction's persuasive authority for the hearing.
Yeah, but I think it also highlights a distinction between, this just says disclosure of facts. Upon disclosure of facts, the public auditor shall consider disqualification, whereas in 9222, there must be an affidavit and a showing. So that's what we're, so it would appear that there is a difference in standard than if taken to its logical conclusion. You know, I'm not trying to belabor it on a 5-page motion, I promise, but if taken to its logical conclusion, it would appear that you're applying, or the public auditor would apply a different standard to themselves than would a hearing officer who inherits all their responsibilities, which I think doesn't really jive with the scheme itself. So again, it's just, you see more similarities in the two statutory schemes. We take the position we see more differences, but you are wearing the robe.
I'm not wearing a dress today, no. I very much appreciate the argument, and thank you for allowing me to get into some of the particulars and about your argument and nuances. If there was clear statute, I think we'd have an easier time here, right? So we just have to go with what's in front of us. Okay, I'll take the matter under advisement unless anybody else wants to be heard on any of these points.
Just briefly, Mr. Hearing Officer, if I might, this is probably a good point in the transcript to put this down. Our JMI's position continues to be the position that we raised in our initial motion regarding the public auditor, that Sule is not the standard, should not be the standard it applies to the public auditor's office. The Guam Supreme, the reason we say that is kind of echoes what the airport said here, but it's that we don't think that the Guam Supreme Court Sule precedent was directed at the public auditor's office. It's sort of a generic precedent to administrative officers. And our position too is that the sort of role that the public auditor's office plays in our island and our broader society sort of more closely matches situations where an appearance standard would apply as opposed to an actual bias standard. We said that about the public auditor. We're going to be consistent, and we're not changing our position on that. I do understand that the law of this case, to me, appears to be has already ruled Sule in his order appointing you. To the extent that that could get revisited here, that let's revisit it. But we understand that's the ruling. The second thing I wanted to say is I still think what we briefed in our first motion could apply here, that the public auditor's office could just decide, as it did in DFS, to move this matter along to the Superior Court, where there's a companion matter on the on initial procurement. The parties are still sort of in their same situations. The third part is, I think there is a distinction between shall and may. You shall recuse versus may recuse. I think the public auditor demonstrated that the may standard is useful in some of these situations, but I'll stop there. It's we're holding the same positions we held from our earlier motion through to this, just to be consistent. Thank you, Mr. Hearing Officer.
Very good. Thank you for that, Mr. Johnson.
Nothing to add.
Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson. Okay, I will take it all under advisement. We'll have we'll issue a decision on it. I do understand your positions, Mr. Brennan. And I very much respect them. Okay. Let's get to the business of scheduling. In the event that I continue to hear the matter. Now, I'm looking at, first we've got to decide this is all prefaced with assuming I continue to hear the matter. We need to come up with a date to hear the outstanding motions, the substantive motions and dispositive motions. And that's there's a motion to dismiss as well as a motion for summary judgment. And I'm looking at Thursday, July 6th, at 10 a.m. for that argument. Is that right, Jerick?
This is correct. That would still be via Zoom.
Via Zoom. How's that date work for everyone?
Mr. Here, this is Josh speaking. Unfortunately, I have some Superior Court pretrial conference matters set at 30. If there was any possibility to do this in the afternoon on that day or Friday at 10 o'clock, that works for my calendar. I would normally be able to get coverage for the Superior Court matters, but as they're pretrial conferences, I'm sure you understand, I want to be there with the judge to figure out what's going on.
Absolutely.
Pretrial conference that morning in district court.
Okay. The afternoon and Friday work for you all, those three blocks, Mr. Johnson?
Yes.
Okay. Thursday, Friday morning block and afternoon block, Mr. Brennan?
Yes, that works.
OPA staff?
So are we good? If you do the Thursday afternoon, we have to do it at 3 a.m. We could do it at 1 p.m.
Okay.
1 or 3, but the only thing is we just have a 2 p.m. So I would maybe suggest 3 p.m. so we won't have to worry about ending if we go beyond an hour. And Friday is open.
Okay. Why don't we do it Friday morning?
Okay.
Thank you.
I see all the folks, the attorneys with the cattle call on the Thursday morning. and I very much appreciate it because some of those can take a while. So 10 a.m. Friday for the motion hearing for motions to dismiss and summary judgment. Okay. Now, in the workup to an actual hearing on the appeal, I'm looking at there needs to be hearing materials provided, as well as a brief in advance of the hearing. And I believe I spoke with the staff earlier, and we're looking at July 31st for the hearing materials and August 4th for briefs on the appeal. Is there any anyone who's not going to be able to make those deadlines?
I have no problem with those dates.
Same for the appellant.
I think the only potential issue is that in the underlying case, there are briefing deadlines. Did you say the 4th for the hearing?
The 4th for the brief. The briefs of the parties for the hearing on the appeal.
And then the hearing date itself?
The hearing date itself, we're looking at the week of the 7th. And
actually, looking at it. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, just looking at it closer, it's a JMI's brief that's due, so I no longer have a problem.
Okay.
For which case?
The underlying appeal. Or the CV 9522.
Your action. Yeah. Your action. And we're very careful about those words around these parts. It is an action.
I think we filed our opening brief. It would be a reply to yours, right? I think is what.
August 8th, yeah. But it's not ours. I opened the calendar.
I'm sorry. And as for the hearing date, Mr. Hearing Officer, was there any way to perhaps move these up a week? I am set to begin a criminal jury trial on Wednesday the 9th that in all likelihood is probably going to go unless we change the Attorney General between now and then, which I don't think is going to happen given the offer that the client has. But if need be, a hearing on Monday the 7th or the 8th with some flexibility to continue dates after that, if you really want to begin the 7th, I'm happy to do that. But
So I will be off island until the 3rd.
Okay.
So that puts me into the following week. And then I have a murder trial the week after this.
Okay. So if we can begin the 7th and maybe wrap, and I will just see how it goes, and that's okay with us. But just for your information, I probably will request that on Wednesday the 9th, we all plan to go dark. sorry.
Okay. Mr. Johnson and Mr. Brennan, any issues with the hearing on the appeal being held at 9 a.m. Monday, August 7th?
No issues on my part.
No objection. I don't think it's going to take too long. I'm hoping this is not going to be a long one.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten too deep in the issues. I haven't reviewed the entire record. But it's a fantastic case. So absolutely. Okay. Anything else from the parties or the staff? Jarek, am I missing anything?
No. We just have some stuff to get through before we get to the end.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson.
Will an order be issued with these dates, sir?
Yes.
Confirm it. Thanks.
Yes. Absolutely. Okay, well, I want to thank everyone for your time today. And we look forward to hopefully continuing as hearing officer and being able to fairly and impartially decide the issues before us. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
We are off the record at 11:07 a.m. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.